Huawei's magnetic personality. Lockbit is still not locked down. AWS frees the transfers. Viavi vies for Spirent. Nutanix raises their IQ. And NetApp moves to remove ransomware in this week's episode of the Gestalt IT Rundown. Hello, everyone. My name is Tom Hollingsworth, and welcome to this March 6th episode of the Gestalt IT Rundown. And happy March to everybody out there, especially if you're a fan of the Oreo cookie, because it is National Oreo Cookie Day. And I am the cream filling to this amazing episode. Joining me is our sandwich cookie co-host, Mr. Stephen Foskett. Stephen, hello.
I have something to admit, Tom. I can't stand Oreo cookies. I know everybody would be blown away by that. I'm not going to even say creamy filling. The white stuff, the white gunk inside them, it's kind of like Molly grease that you got under the chassis of your car. Just nasty, nasty stuff.
How do you feel about cheesecake? Because it's also National Cheesecake Day.
No, it's National White Chocolate Cheesecake Day. And let me tell you, white chocolate isn't chocolate. Boy, I sound grumpy today.
Man, well, I'm glad I got you fired up because we have some great news stories that we're going to be covering, and hopefully we can bring a little bit of that fire to these things that have been going on in the tech industry for this first week of March. And so I'm going to start off talking about, well, storage, because yay, why not? But it's actually something really neat because Huawei appears to be chilling in the storage market. Specifically, they've announced during Mobile World Congress last week that they're developing magnetoelectric disks for cold storage. The hope is that it is designed to reduce costs compared to traditional hard disk drives, but also tape storage. A new rack of these magnetoelectric drives will have up to 10 petabytes of storage and consume less than 2 kilowatts of power. Now, that's like a 90% reduction from what a traditional hard drive rack would probably cost. And according to what I've seen, this is a first. Nobody has developed this technology before, which kind of makes me wonder, Stephen, why is Huawei developing this technology?
Well, I think we need to say right off the bat that we have no idea what this technology is. Nobody is saying what it is. Yeah, they talked about it a little bit. Chris Millar tried to dig into it and couldn't figure out what they were talking about either. I have a suspicion that this is maybe not as exciting as it sounds. So hear me out. First off, magnetoelectric disk. So as Millar points out in the article that we're linking to here, that implies that this is a disk because, you know, the word is right there in the name, which in turn implies that this thing has a similar form factor to a hard drive, which suggests that this is some kind of hard drive media. Now, we've talked a bit before about heat-assisted magnetic recording and all of these microwave-assisted and all these other technologies that are out there. Magnetoelectric, well, what it says, what those words say to me and to others that have looked into this is that this is probably a new type of storage media. It's certainly a new type of disk media. And the advantage of it would be a reduction in power. That's important because a lot of these other technologies that are coming out there to pack more and more density onto a disk drive, well, they take a lot of power because most of them are basically energetically activating the disk, whether through microwaves or heat or lasers or whatever. This thing may be different. This one may, for example, use voltage instead of current to adjust the magnetic properties of the disk. That would dramatically reduce the amount of, well, current needed to power the disk, theoretically. They may also be doing some other clever tricks. You know, Millar is speculating that maybe they have a different form factor. I'm actually suspicious of that one because, frankly, the 2.5-inch hard drive form factor, the reason that it's so dominant is frankly because you can pack a lot of them into a conventional 1U server or 2U server. So, you know, they're just really convenient. If you went to like a big, giant, you know, 8-inch disk or something, well, you're not going to fit many of them in a server, are you? Theoretically, they could be doing something like that, but I don't know. My speculation, based on what we know, is that this is a new disk media that Huawei is going to introduce and try to use it to compete with next generation disk. It will probably offer lower power consumption. It'll probably be theoretically reliable. I'm not even sure it's going to be that dense, though. 10 petabytes in a rack sounds like a lot, but by my calculation, that's only 10 terabytes in a 2.5 inch, you know, 24, 2.5 inch drives, you know, that kind of thing. You do the math, that comes out to 10 terabytes per drive, which is not actually that big. But maybe I'm completely off base and this thing is absolutely the world changing. I guess we'll see. Hey, Huawei, give me a call. I'd love to learn more about this. Lockbit may have been locked out by the federal government, but that isn't stopping it from spreading. 2 days after the takedown of the ransomware crew, there were versions of the software being actively used to exploit a ConnectWise vulnerability in the wild. There's some question about whether or not the group is going to doing the exploiting. Is the actual Lockbit crew, as a version of their software was leaked back in 22, it could be even somebody else. Researchers are continuing to investigate this and ensure proper attribution, and also to confirm that Lockbit has truly been taken offline, which it sounds like they're claiming they haven't.
Of course they're going to want to claim that they haven't, because if they've been taken offline, nobody has to pay, right? So that's exactly what's happening here, is the researchers are trying to figure out, is this the remnants of the Lockbit crew that still has access to like some old builds and things like that, or is this a new group that is trying to jump in and use that leaked build from a couple of years ago? Because it could be very important to figure out exactly how to recover from this stuff. So one of the things is that the feds went and seized all of their assets, right? Which means they have the decryption keys. That's important, because if you have the decryption keys, that means that anybody who gets infected with a current version of the software, you can just say, don't pay, we'll send you the keys. That's what the FBI did a couple years ago when they nabbed the guys that did the Kaseya hack. It's like, we have all the keys, don't worry about it. But if they're using a different branch of the code that has a different seed, or they've changed the way that the keys work, then we're right back to square one and we got to figure this out. Plus, and the analogy is apt, but also kind of horrifying. It's almost like cancer. Just when you think you've gotten all of it, all it takes is one cell to survive, and it can keep spreading. And if they create a development group on top of one of those branched pieces of code, who knows what can happen. Now, one thing I will say that does make this feel a little bit easier is, no matter whether this is the remnants of the Lockbit group or an offshoot group that has access to the code, one thing we know they don't have is the framework that Lockbit was using to turn this into a very efficient business. So if you want to use an analogy, this is not the Five Families of New York in La Cosa Nostra. This is some two-bit thugs with a crowbar on the corner, like extorting people for a little bit of cash. It's not an organized thing. It's not streamlined to the point where it's an effective use. It's just some people posturing. That doesn't mean it's not bad, because all it takes is one group getting affected, or, you know, one hospital getting locked down, and then we're right back to where we are. So I know that the researchers in the government is really trying to make sure that they stamped all this out, because we don't want to give them an environment where they can come back from whatever we did to them. And if it's a new group, we want to stem that before they can actually get out there and start doing stuff. So fingers crossed, we can get rid of this with radiation or whatever it's going to take to get rid of them. Well, Stephen, I can't believe that we've actually found ourselves here, but Google can finally claim that AWS is just following the cool kids. It's because Amazon announced this week that they are also going to allow free unrestricted data transfers between cloud providers. Now, you may recall back on January the 17th, we discussed the Google announcement that they were going to be doing this. And I feel like maybe this is kind of designed to make developers feel like maybe they're not going to be locked into a given cloud environment. And that could have something to do with the fact that this is now something that's being mandated by the European Data Act, which is designed to spur competition between cloud providers that are out there. But Stephen, I wanted to give you a chance to kind of weigh in on this, since you, you know, now that we see this kind of domino effect going, what does having free unrestricted data egress mean for companies that are doing cloud adoption?
Well, you know, I think that paradoxically, having free data egress might mean that companies are more willing to put their data in the cloud. And, you know, hear me out. One of the fears that people have of putting too much data in the cloud and doing too much work in the cloud is that basically then their data is, well, I don't want to say held ransom, but that their data is being held closely by a cloud provider who's then going to charge them to stop using it. There's some fear about this, and there's some worry about the surprises that could be in store if you try to bring your data back out and rehome it back on site. One of the things that was a benefit from Google's announcement, I think, and one of the things that Google was really looking for was to reassure customers that you can try the Google Cloud, you can do your data processing there, and if you need to get your data out, you can, and we're not going to ding you on the cost. Well, for a long time, that's been a thing with Amazon, and frankly, it's been a FUD. I'm not sure that it's really a concern all that much. I mean, basically, if you've got enough money to be storing a ton of data in Amazon S3, you probably have enough to pay the egress fees too. But that being said, Amazon, as you said, following Google's lead here, they're going to offer free data transfers out. Now, there's an asterisk on this, and it's a big asterisk. Number one, it is not unrestricted. You have to request access. You have to request it if you want to get your data out for free. Number two, it's not actually free. It's credits. And so basically, on request, they'll give you credits that will cover the cost of moving your data out. Now, the bottom line is that means you don't pay the money for the thing, which means it's free. But it's not really as free and unrestricted as maybe you might think it is. I do think that this has everything to do with regulations. There's been a lot of concern in Europe, especially over cloud lock-in. There's a lot of suggestions that the European authorities might be looking into this stuff. And if I was Amazon, I would definitely want to head it off by offering something that would, you know, address their concerns without maybe actually reducing costs all that much. So that's pretty much what this is. I absolutely expect Microsoft and everybody else to follow suit as well, simply because now this is going to be a standard way of doing business. And like I said at the top, I don't think this is going to cause a lot of data movement. I think it's just going to set customers' minds at ease that if the time comes and they need to move their data, they can. Testing firm and Field Day presenter Spirent is being acquired by Viavi Solutions for around $1.2 billion. Spirent is being acquired in an all-cash transaction, and it's expected to booster Viavi's testing labs to provide even better assurance solutions for customers. The move comes as Spirent has seen revenues fall over the past year, and the UK-based companies being picked up due to weakness in the British pound. Viavi will receive a $400 million investment from Silver Lake Capital as part of this acquisition. Now, Tom, Spirent has a long and interesting history. What do you take of this?
I take it as Viavi realizing that they needed to add some additional pieces to their testing portfolio and kind of round out their labs. And let's be fair, if I'm a company that's wanting to do some testing today, am I going to want to go to a company that is extremely focused on one very narrow aspect of this? Or am I going to want to go somewhere where I can get like the whole soup to nuts kind of solution? And I know which one I'm going to pick, honestly, even if it's a little bit more money, because then that way I know that I'm getting a whole complete round of this testing. And I loved Spirent when we got to look at them all the way back. What was it, like Networking Field Day 4, when I was still a delegate at Networking Field Day? And it's fascinating to me to see kind of how the whole testing methodology and things like that work. But here's the problem. Testing methodology only works when customers are willing to pay for it. And I think that that's where we're starting to see things in the market kind of narrow down a little bit. I mean, according to the reports, Spirent, their revenues were down like something like 33% last year. And when you couple that with the fact that the British pound is a whole lot weaker now, thanks to other things that are going on, it's almost like it's a bargain to pick up these companies. So when you look at what the transaction amount was, it was really like right at 1 billion pounds. So do the math. It's like 1.3 billion US dollars. But that's offset by a $400 million investment from Silver Lake Capital into Viavi. The CEO of Viavi used to be at Silver Lake Capital. So I think that this is kind of Silver Lake going to them and saying, hey, we want you to make a run of this as a larger company. We're willing to put our money where our mouth is. But maybe kind of the undertone is that if something doesn't work out, we have enough pieces here that we can package them up and sell them off as a separate entity that we can use to recoup our investment. and then kind of see where things go from there. Now, that's not to say that what we're offering here is not good. I mean, it is absolutely great when you look, you know, these two had similar overlap, but not enough of a similar overlap where it feels like that we're taking a competitor out of the market with this acquisition. In fact, I think what it's going to do is it's going to augment those pieces, and it's really going to allow these companies to kind of grow and challenge some of those really big giants out there that are, you know, kind of focusing on things like 800 gig Ethernet or 5G or whatever AI assurance is going to end up looking like. I think that having them as kind of a neutral third party, if you can say they're neutral, or at least they don't work for these companies, is a way to kind of provide value to people who want to get these things certified. So I'm actually kind of bullish on this acquisition. And of course, it's two field day presenting companies. So how can I not like to see companies succeed like that? So, you know, we'll definitely keep up with this. And who knows, maybe we can get them back to a future field day and we can talk about all that cool testing stuff again. Steven, Nutanix has reportedly decided to acquire some of the assets of D2iQ. Now, that news comes amid reports that D2iQ was going to be shutting down their operations and distributing their assets to certain creditors. You may remember that D2iQ originally started off as a company called Mesosphere, and they were very focused on doing Kubernetes cloud. And the funny thing is if you were doing Kubernetes back in 2020, obviously Google was really interested in buying you. That didn't pan out. And then Microsoft was going to acquire the company, but they rejected Microsoft's offer of, I think it was somewhere north of $250 million. And now we're here where we're at today, where Nutanix gets some of the assets and have onboarded some of the D2iQ employees to help with this kind of scaling up. And I know that Nutanix has really been in the news recently because of all the things that have been going on with VMware and Broadcom. But Steven, I guess the question is, does adding Kubernetes support or Kubernetes things to Nutanix give them a leg up on where they want to go with things today?
Well, absolutely it does. And I think this is a great acquisition for Nutanix. You know, the D2iQ's Kubernetes platform was really strong. It was a pretty impressive platform. As Nutanix says in their press release, it's like having a new Nutanix expert on staff. I wouldn't say that it's quite that good, but it's really pretty good. It's a great way to bring best practices-based Kubernetes platforms to, you know, to market for customers and even for MSPs and so on. So it is a strong platform. Having that bundled with the Nutanix hyperconverged infrastructure and virtualization platform makes a lot of sense, just like it makes sense for VMware. If you'll remember, VMware's goal under Broadcom is private cloud. VMware is 100% focused on delivering a private cloud platform that gives their customers everything they need to have a competitive private solution that does all the things that the public cloud platforms do. I'm not going to say that D2iQ gets all that for Nutanix, but it gets them way along that path. And I think that that's really a positive move. I also am glad to see that some of the folks who are working on these products, some of the team, will be joining Nutanix. I wish them all the best there, because again, they've done good stuff. They've put together a good product. It wasn't their fault that the product didn't sell all that well. And now within Nutanix, I think it makes a lot more sense. So yeah, I give this this announcement a thumbs up, and I wish all the best for Nutanix and their customers, because another alternative to VMware is on the corner. IBM is making their storage software smarter when it comes to ransomware. They've added AI enhancements to their FlashCore modules, which are designed to detect storage anomalies at the block level. This inline analysis can be used to detect when ransomware attempts to encrypt or destroy data during an attack. They've also made improvements to Storage Defender, a resilience solution that puts elements of various offerings together to allow for quick detection and streamlined recovery of data should attackers strike. I was at the IBM focused Share conference, that's a mainframe focused conference, earlier this week. A lot of talk about ransomware in the mainframe space. Certainly a lot of talk about this from a lot of storage platforms. Tom, you don't come from the storage background, you come from the security background. So what do you make of this?
Well, I think it's interesting that IBM storage is kind of getting up there where a lot of our other storage companies have really been expanding this idea of ransomware, because I liken it to the measures that people would take to keep pests out of storage of other, you know, perishable goods like grains or, you know, fruits and vegetables. Like once they get in there, if you don't know that they're in there, you could lose entire, you know, warehouses full of important assets, right? So sub strawberries for hard drives and sub pests for ransomware attackers. And the sooner you can get to them, the lower the dwell time, the better it is. Well, you can't get any lower than in line. And that's one of the things that our friend Krista McComber over at the Futurum Group mentioned in the linked article, is this inline scanning capability really gives IBM a leg up for their customers because they can see this as it's happening. And for those of you who don't know, kind of one of the things that a lot of these data protection companies are doing is they're doing entropy detection. So if you can't compress data, that means it's encrypted, right? Well, if you didn't encrypt it, somebody did. And that's usually step one in trying to figure out, am I under attack right now? So you're reducing the dwell time from we've encrypted everything to we encrypted some of the data and we're trying to stop people from getting to the rest of it. And I think that that's a valuable thing for people that want to have that reassurance. If I have, you know, terabytes and petabytes and exabytes and yottabytes and whatever else of data out there, I want to make sure that I can still get to it. And that's where the Storage Defender platform comes into play too. Because as we've talked about many, many times, and I'll quote our good friend Curtis Preston here, it's not just backup, it's backup and recovery. You have to have a plan for what happens when things go wrong. And that's where Storage Defender comes in handy. Yes, we're going to detect it when something goes wrong. But in the event that something does, we're going to have an option for you to recover things. And that is a huge valuable thing, because now I know that I can quickly replace the data and I can eject the attackers out of my network and I can make sure that I'm not losing anything, because lost data means lost money, means anger customers, and it means regulatory filings, because you have to now within 2 weeks, you have to tell people that you were impacted. I don't have to do a lot of extra paperwork. And I don't want to tell my customers, hey, funny thing happened on the way to the store. Your data got lost. So I'm excited to see that IBM is kind of integrating this into their storage platforms. And given the resurgence in IBM storage as of late, I think this is a huge selling point, because in today's market, you have to have a data protection solution, no matter what it is, because customers are not going to buy something where there's a chance, as low as it might be, that they can get infected or have things destroyed by things that are outside of their control. And so I think that this is something that is going to be valuable for IBM's marketing in the future. And one thing that I think is exciting about this is, given the discussion that we've been having around data protection and other topics like this at Security Field Day, I'd love to see IBM come to the event and tell us more about what they're doing and let our group of security-focused delegates kind of dig into it. Because I promise you, with folks like Krista McComber and a lot of the other people in the industry who really understand the technology, if they can explain it to our delegates, there's not a customer on this planet that's not going to want to buy it right away. So IBM, give me a call. I got a place for you to show us everything. Well, Stephen, speaking of ransomware and storage, we've got something we wanted to take a little bit of a closer look at, because our good friends over at NetApp have been updating their ransomware protection solutions, and they've made some new additions to their automated ransomware protection platform, the ARP platform, to address new attack vectors and improve logic for attack detection, including methods like not encrypting all of your data, just encrypting some of it and kind of causing all kinds of chaos because you don't know what got hit. Now, one of the things that I think is a huge discussion point here is the fact that NetApp is claiming a 99% precision in detection of ransomware attacks. They've also announced availability of their ransomware recovery guarantee for Keystone, which is their storage as a service offering. And all of this comes wrapped in part of a larger package full of announcements to things like Snap Center and BlueXP disaster recovery. But as you mentioned, I'm a security guy, so I'm going to want to focus on the security stuff. But I kind of wanted to open this up to you, because you've had a long history working with NetApp, and we've seen them many times at our field day events over the years. What do you think about NetApp getting into this market where they're, you know, doing all kinds of detection and things like that. Because one of the things that Krista McComber mentioned in this article is that you no longer have to reboot everything to get the latest definitions for these detection systems. You can kind of slipstream them into the logic. So I no longer have to take everything down to basically, if this is how old I am, install new virus definitions. Like, we can keep going at speed. So where do you see the value in these kinds of software offerings coming in a storage platform?
Well, I think there's a huge value in that. So I guess let's dive into that first. So as you know, NetApp is one of the very few companies out there that remains 100% focused on data infrastructure, storage solutions, you know, data protection, that sort of thing. They really are, you know, a storage company. And that gives them a unique perspective on this whole market. Ransomware fundamentally is a storage problem. Essentially, we've got companies that are trying to defend the data that is stored on their storage systems. And we've got attackers that are trying to compromise that data. As we discussed with NetApp at a special field day event last year, and as we continue to discuss with a lot of these companies in the storage and data protection space, storage systems are in a unique position to respond to ransomware simply because that's where the data goes. So if you have smarts in the storage system, it can monitor things. It can watch as data is changed. It can detect if data is being encrypted. It can detect anomalous and unusual access patterns. And storage systems can, theoretically, shut that stuff down. That being said, storage systems are really a servant to applications, and you really don't want your storage platform routinely refusing to store data because it might be ransomware, because that would get in the way of all the other things that you're trying to do with your infrastructure. So what this all means is that if you're a storage system provider or a data infrastructure provider like NetApp, you have to be pretty careful here in how you implement these things. If you make it too aggressive at avoiding ransomware, well, then the system's just not going to work. And then people aren't going to buy it because you won't be able to do whatever you're supposed to be doing. But on the other hand, if you just say, well, that's a problem for an upper layer, I'm not going to worry about ransomware, well, then that doesn't help either. Another challenge here is that some of the ransomware authors are getting smart, and they're actually attacking storage arrays. There have been a lot of stories about ransomware systems that go after data protection, that go after storage arrays, that go after snapshots and clones and replicated data as a way to, one, keep from being stymied by storage system features like clones and snapshots, and two, make it even more efficient to lock companies out of their data. Now, for this point, NetApp actually has some pretty nice stuff. One of the capabilities NetApp has is this thing called SnapLock that they've had for a long time. And it's basically, it basically makes the data read-only. SnapLock really works well, and it's hard to undo it. So in other words, if you're trying to modify data whether it's through encryption or just deleting it or whatever, it's really hard to get around SnapLock because NetApp built that thing to be very resilient. It built it for regulatory reasons. And by having that integrated into a ransomware defense, well, that's a lot better than what you might get from a system that is just detecting encryption and stopping encryption, or a system that just has some snapshots here or there that could be deleted. SnapLock is much, much more secure. The other thing that I really like here is that they're integrating this with BlueXP. You may not know about this, but BlueXP is a unified data management platform that NetApp has for hybrid cloud. And everything I've heard from NetApp and from NetApp customers is that BlueXP is a really nice solution. Having that integrated really helps, because fundamentally, what we're dealing with here, and this is what I want you to talk about, Tom, because I'm interested in your perspective on this. The problem is that most storage people aren't security people, and vice versa. Most security people don't really know much about storage capabilities, storage systems, the risks of storage, et cetera. And so really, it's incumbent on companies like NetApp and IBM and Pure Storage and Dell and all these other, as well as companies like, you know, Rubrik and Veeam and Commvault and Cohesity, all these data protection companies, they have to make their solutions friendly to the security user as well as to the data protection, data management, or storage user.
Yeah, the problem is that when you focus your entire career on doing something like storing data or moving data or things like that, you never think of the negative aspects of it. And I quote everyone's favorite uncle, Gunnery Sergeant Hartman, if it wasn't for a-holes like you, there wouldn't be any thievery in the world. Well, if it wasn't for people who are trying to steal your data and get you to buy it back from them, there wouldn't be any ransomware in the world. And if it was just script kiddies from the 90s who are defacing websites, we wouldn't care. The problem is that there's value in the data. And so if you can get to it where it lives, that part of the reason why they're doing that now is because they're trying to get to it where nobody's going to notice. I mean, you know, it's like the warehouse in Raiders of the Lost Ark, right? Like, there's so many boxes in there. Who knows what's in there? And who? How many times have you just walked up and down the rows and started counting serial numbers? They're hoping that they can encrypt this data, that you won't know it until you go to access it. And then all of a sudden, boom, I have a potential client. You know, because we've seen a lot of focus on, like, you know, protecting data in flight, you know, NDR, XDR, all of the DR type stuff, detection and response. I mean, when you think about it, most of the in-flight stuff now is encrypted with TLS anyway. So, like, it's difficult to get to that packet. But boy, once it gets stored, like, I don't know anybody who's encrypting all of their volumes with, you know, any kind of, like, you know, solution, because it's expensive. From a CPU perspective, it reduces the amount of storage that you can use because the data becomes non-compressible. So I'm just going to keep it out there, and I'm going to hope nobody knows how to get to it. Well, that ship sailed, unfortunately. So security people do need to have a security mindset, but more importantly, they need to know to work with the security team to understand how these features work. Because, like, for me, when I started out, a snapshot was just a quick way to say, okay, if something breaks when I'm about to do this update, I can always roll back. Now, snapshots are a security feature. I make an immutable snapshot, and that way I know that no matter what happens from this point forward, I can always roll back there. It doesn't mean that I have a perfect backup copy, but it means that I have a starting point so that I don't have to completely reset this from scratch. But like you said, the people who are doing this are getting smarter about that. And I think that's something that storage and security people need to understand, is that every time you plug a leak, they're going to find another way to drill a hole. And it's getting more and more sophisticated. And that sounds a little, I don't know, frightening, but it's actually a good thing. Because by plugging all of the other leaks, what you're doing is you're keeping the untalented people out of your network. It's no different than installing a lock on a door or an alarm system or something like that. You're not trying to keep out the dedicated people who are going to break into your house. You're trying to keep out the people who are just looking for a house to break into. Ones who are like, oh, I'm going to run this tool, and man, if it finds some stuff, great, I can exploit that. No, this is a concerted effort by everybody in the system to kind of integrate those security pieces. You've heard the term shift left in security a lot. That means moving security considerations further down the line, earlier into the development cycle. And that's where I think that we're seeing this from an infrastructure perspective. We're looking at the data while it's moving. We're looking at the data while it's being stored. We're looking at who's accessing the data. We're looking at the capabilities of people to move laterally in a network through things like microsegmentation. We're understanding that true data security is at every piece of the conversation. It's not just, oh, well, once we lock it behind this lock and key, it's safe. And I'm glad that companies like NetApp are starting to understand that. And like I said earlier, I feel like this is becoming kind of a table stakes part of the conversation. Like, nobody is going to buy from a storage company that doesn't have some kind of a data protection offering, whether it's as something as simple as doing, you know, like encryption detection, entropy detection, or realistically speaking, it's this integrated approach where my devices are feeding a SOAR or a SIEM so that I know that this is going on. And that's where I wanted to come back to that 99% assurance rate. We've all dealt with alert fatigue, right? Like, oh, why is that light red? I don't know. Well, if it's red, it's probably something important, except when it's not. When you have a 99% precision, what that means is we know beyond a shadow of a doubt that if this thing got triggered, you need to take a look at it. That means that it keeps your security teams sharp. So they're not just chasing phantoms. It's not like, you know, the throwing the pebble to distract the guard that you see in the movies all the time. These are the kinds of things that matter to security professionals. And we've heard it at Security Field Day a lot. I don't want you to just throw alerts. I want you to throw high quality alerts that I know are going to be valid for what I need to do to address the situation. And so, Stephen, you know, as a storage administrator, you also have a good background in security. I think you can see the value in not only being precise, but also in, you know, making sure that we're protected at all steps of this kind of storage conversation.
Yeah. And to that point, I think, Tom, that the most important thing that I'm looking for these days is companies that can really have the conversation in a credible way with storage professionals. As you mentioned, having anti-ransomware features is table stakes now for storage and data protection products. I expect any product in storage, any product in data protection to have ransomware features. What I'm looking at, though, is the quality of those features and also the quality of the company in terms of their ability to discuss those features. So, for example, our friends over at Commvault, they hired a bunch of really credible security experts to come in and join the company, to join an advisory group, and to help the company to be able to have these conversations with security pros. When we look at what happens at security field day, as opposed to a storage field day or a data infrastructure field day or whatever, what the delegates are looking for is those kind of quality voices, the kind of people who can come in and say, you know, hey, I'm a security person. You know, that's my background. I'm not a storage nerd. And I want to talk to you about this in terms that make sense to you. So when I'm looking at security field day, that's what I'm going to be looking for from these companies. I'm going to be looking for the data protection and storage companies to come in there and say, yeah, you know what? We make storage systems, but here's an expert on security. And they're going to come in and talk about how to use these features and how to make best use of those. And I think that that's what's going to impress the security field day delegates, but also, of course, the audience, the security audience. And it's going to make them maybe go over and talk to their security folks or their storage folks and say, hey, we use NetApp, right? Could we maybe integrate some of these features into our security posture? That's the conversation I want to hear.
Well, good news for you, Stephen, because if that's the conversation you want to hear, we have an event coming up where all kinds of conversations like that are going to be happening. So in the weeks ahead, April 10th and 11th, so about a month from now, we're going to be having Security Field Day 11. And we have a great lineup of companies that are going to be talking to us about all kinds of security-focused products, whether they're firewalls or cloud security or, you know, SASE or data protection. You can go to techfieldday.com and you click on the link for Security Field Day, and you can always catch the latest group of people who are presenting, as well as the delegates who are going to be there, including Krista McComber, who we've mentioned a couple of times here from the Futurum Group, as well as Shira Rubinoff. And we're very excited to have her there. She is one of the leading names in the cybersecurity space. And I know she's going to have an opinion on some of the things that are going on. And Stephen, after that, you're on deck with something cool.
Yeah, that's right, Tom. As I know well, looking forward to Edge Field Day once again coming up in May. In fact, we're getting a lot of really exciting companies coming in and interested in that. I'll be making more announcements as that thing gets closer. And you're going to be making some announcements about mobility, huh?
You're right, I am, because just a couple weeks after you finish up with Edge Field Day, I'm taking all the wires away, and we're going to be doing Mobility Field Day 11. We already have wonderful commitments from Fortinet, Juniper, Arista, and we'll be adding many more companies to that list very shortly. I'm waiting on the paperwork to come back from them. And we've got a wonderful lineup of delegates. You know, they're some of the brightest people in their space. They know what they're talking about. In fact, a few of them actually helped me design the wireless network at my house. So I'm excited to be back in front of them because, you know, the mobility space is always moving, pun fully intended, forward in there's a lot of cool technologies. We might even talk about Wi-Fi 7. Do you know what that is? If you don't, you will by the time we get done there. But if you need to keep up with the news every week between now and then, you know where to find us. We're here every Wednesday, 12:30 Eastern time with your favorite news show. Better than any of the cable outlets, better than any of the websites.
Yeah, it's you hear rundown. That, John Stewart? We're better than your show.
Yes, and I'll challenge you, John Stewart. Let's have a conversation about ransomware. I want to see if you can keep up with me and with Stephen. And when that happens, we'll make an announcement on all of our social feeds using the hashtag rundown. We'll have the recording. If you want to listen to us as a podcast, you can check us out in your favorite podcast application of choice. And also make sure you head over to the website, gestaltit.com, and check out the show notes, because there's a lot of wonderful articles that we link to. We can't read them all verbatim because that would be bad, but we give you our take on them, but we provide the details so you can get your fix of the news that you want to read. We'll be back next week with another great episode, and we will have more fun things to cover. I'm sure there's going to be some networking news, some storage news, some security news. Somebody's going to get bought. Somebody's going to get hacked. Whatever it is, we're going to be here for you. And we'll even tell you what exciting dessert is going on that day. But until then, don't desert us. Stick where you're at. 1 week, we'll be back with more great content. Take care of yourselves and have an white chocolate Oreo cheesecake today or something like that. See you guys later.